Guten Morgen von meiner Seite aus. Ich begrüße Sie zur Fortfahren unseres Programms. Und zwar haben wir den letzten Vortrag in der zweiten Sektion über Zeitlichkeit und Geschichte. Und ich freue mich sehr, Avinoam Shalem an dieser Stelle einzuführen. Herr Shalem hat Kunstgeschichte studiert in Tel Aviv, München und Edinburgh und vor allem gearbeitet über Dinge, über Objekte, islamische Objekte, nämlich Elfenbeine, Kristalle, Metall, Glas, alles, was es eben so gibt und im Besonderen in christlichen Kirchen im abendländischen Mittelalter. Das war seine Dissertation über Islam Christianized. Dann kam eine Monographie über Olifanten. So nennt man Olifanten, naja. Also Olifant, Elefant ist nicht sehr, sehr weit. Und nämlich geht es tatsächlich um die Stoßzähne der Elefanten zu Blashörner umgearbeitet. Das ist ein Olifant. Also eine Monographie darüber, es kommt auch ein Korpus dieser Objekte, die vom, ich sag mal hier vom Stil her, von den Formen her eben sich mal in Byzanz, mal im Islam, mal in Süditalien verorten. Und das sind eben diese Probleme, die Avinoam Shalem besonders interessieren. Erwähnen möchte ich noch ein Band, was er mit herausgegeben hat, über Austausch diplomatischer Geschenke in Spätantike und Byzanz. Damit habe ich schon deutlich gemacht, glaube ich, dass es eben um sich bewegende Objekte und Dinge in dem Raum, in der Zeit. Darum wird es im Zusammenhang mit Kubler auch sofort gehen, mit dem Titel Histories of Belonging and George Kubler's Prime Object. Avinoam, bitte.
Also zuerst danke Philipp und danke die Organisatoren dieser Konferenz. Ich freue mich hier sehr zu sein und entschuldige schon auch bei Ihnen. Ich würde gern heute bis Ende noch bleiben, aber ich muss heute Nachmittag schon auf dem Weg nach München. Es tut mir sehr leid, das wollte ich nicht. While discussing the historian's difficult task of writing history, having usually at his hand scanty evidence and sometimes only traces of rather elusive influences, Siegfried Krakauer comments, and I cite, "It occurs to me that the only reliable information on these matters, which are so difficult to ascertain, is a legendary figure, Ahasuerus, the wandering Jew. He indeed would know firsthand about the developments and transitions, for he alone in all history has had the unthought opportunity to exercise the process of becoming and decaying itself. How unspeakably terrible he must look. To be sure, his face cannot have suffered from aging, but I imagine it to be many faces, each reflecting one of the period which he traversed, and all of them combining into ever new patterns as he restlessly and vainly tries in his wandering to reconstruct out of the times that shaped him and the one time that he doomed to incarnate." And I accentuate where Krakauer is saying, out of the time that shaped him and the time that he doomed to incarnate. It is beyond the scope of this short article to discuss the specific personal reason of Krakauer to focus on the image of Ahasuerus, the wandering Jew, as the proper metaphor for the multifaceted image that any historical event or evidence take in the flow of time. I wonder also if his grasping on the figure of Ahasuerus reflect his personal state of being in the USA as an exiled intellectual Jew and his biography, which has been tinted by the turbulent and restless moment of the European history of the first half of the 20th century. His last sentence, however, clearly refers to the specific art historian's ideas of time, especially to those of Henri Fussion and George Kubler. Krakauer, clearly aware in his book of the vie de forme and the shape of time, or as he says, the Fussion-Kubler's view. And yet, he shifts our interest in his book from the histories of style of Fussion and the primary object of Kubler, and emphasizes the multifaceted character of any evidence in history. As an art historian, Krakauer does not distinguish between literary and material evidence. Thus, beside the primary face which each object of art is supposed to have or doomed to incarnate, and which we, the art historian, try to reconstruct from the object's multiple process of decaying and becoming, Krakauer calls our attention to the many temporal sequences of each event, period, epoch, and, I would add, artifacts. It seems, therefore, that a new interpretive paradigm is needed. Perhaps a new system for understanding the multi-layered history of things, which will go beyond the dialectics between the imagined chronological flow of time and the temporal spatial sequences negating it. The ideas of Krakauer expressed in the 60s in his specific chapter on Ahasuerus and the Riddle of Time announce the coming of a new system or notion of interpretation in our modern era, the network. Bruno Latour described this system in his book We Have Never Been Modern, first published in French in 1991, Nous n'avons jamais été modernes, essai d'anthropologie symétrique, and later published in 1993 by Harvard University Press described this network as, and I quote, more subtle than the notion of system, more historical than the notion of structure, more empirical than the notion of complexity. His argument that the apparatus, matrix, or framework of decoding histories and objects used in any discussion or interpretive approach while activating and being tightly related to terms such as translation and network suggests that the idea of connection and the traffic of thoughts is at the core of interpretive theories, as if the whole process of thinking is defined as a woven space of a cognitive character which binds and joins. Constrained within the metaphoric realm of Latour's suggestion of movement and transportability, and allowed me to simplify his hypothesis, I would suggest that with the rapid growth of actions and movements and the increase of our consciousness to the phenomenon of travel and migration, a shift of scholarly interest occurs in which places of departure and the location of destination fall out of focus, or are even sometimes ignored, and alternative interactive spaces and contact zones and the sets of contacts between these specific sites have become the focus of the so-called network discourse. Much has been written in the last two decades on the transfer and transportability of objects in medieval time and in the pre-modern era. These streams of research has mainly aimed to shift scholarly interest from the traditional manner of discussing the phenomenon of transfer and movement as solely related to artifact sites of departure and arrival to rather specific life spans during which objects actually travel or are in transfer. Thus, the state of things at rest, be it the object life in its place of origin, involving the identity of the craftsman, the craftsman technique or manufacturing process, be it more or less the inactive life in the hands of an owner at either that size of origin or in another places, or be it the immobile state of object of aesthetic display all these are replaced by dynamic spaces in which artifacts move and migrate. By concentrating instead on objects of art as autonomous objects and not on the particular spaces in which they operate, the personal histories of objects are highlighted. The result of this notion is the appearance of a new system or matrix or imaginative lines which follow the intersecting roots of objects and their particular biographies, creating therefore a novel set of network. Whereas the former interest lies in the definition of places and geographical spaces as the arena of historical context in which objects operate, here, in this form of thinking, the life story, the traces of the object adventurers, are drawn. In short, the static manner of traditional art history, in which the location of style and culture are primarily investigated, is left aside to provide new space for the dynamic of artistic practice. Transformation, translation processes, and ideas of change afflict scholarly notion of interest and even dictate the parameter within which art historians act and think today. This intellectual tendency gives birth to particular terms so much in vogue today, such as alteration, modification, adjustment, conversion, displacement, and replacement, all of which stress the dynamics of artistic actions and behaviors. Nevertheless, since much of these theoretical studies on the social life of object is mainly nurtured by philological, anthropological, cultural, historical, and philosophical-based theories, mostly shaped by positivist epistemological approaches toward the object, namely toward its physical presence, the main focus given to artifact in art historical debate was clearly bound to the tangible aspect of the object as material, as having form and shape. Thus, question of alteration and adaptation and even destruction were linked to the object's corporal characteristic. The anima of the object, on the contrary, has usually been neglected, namely the thoughts that objects carry with them not only physical, tangible evidence, but the idea and memory, be they contrived, legendary or semi-historical, that they could even evoke the object emotion were rarely addressed. Operating then within the multi-level structure of network organized as three-dimensional space, the whole system of network could then be elevated from its usual illustration as a two-dimensional grid. Vectors of linkage between artifacts could therefore run parallel to each other and at the same time on different spheres. I would like to argue that objects of art operate within this system of multi-leveled network and illustrate not only a linear picture of transfers and movement, but rather a similarly multi-layered system of transculturation. I'm going to skip something here. I've shortened it yesterday night, I must say. I've just put this picture here just to get us into the kind of the mood of meditating on the object, this experience that we usually have in each museum and how we actually read object when we are standing in a museum. And in a way, I like this picture because it's very cognitive in its atmosphere, the moment of thinking in front of an object. Let me illustrate these complexities through a specific example, a monstrance reliquary from the German National Museum in Nuremberg. A few small relics, stitches onto an embroidered vegetal motif, are displayed within a small square and flat rock crystal container, which is just here at the very center, this piece here. That is the heart of the whole object. They appear in the very center of this monstrance and are framed by a rock crystal ring and elevated on a relatively long and elaborated stem that you see here. A quick look at this object reveals to the beholder that the monstrance is clearly made out of several segments, at least three, which differ in time and style. Its present name, the Crescent of Al-Zahir, refers to the magnificent rock crystal ring, which bears the carved Kufic inscription, Lilla ad-Din, Lil-Zahir, Li'izaz, Din Allah, Atala Allah Baka Ihi. The religion is for Allah only, Ali Al-Zahir, Li'izaz, Din Allah, God will prolong his life. The crescent made of two identical curved pieces fastened to each other was most probably kept in the Fatimid treasury in Cairo and formed part of the treasures of the Fatimid Caliph Al-Zahir, who reigned between 1021 and 1036. Unfortunately, it's impossible to trace how and through which itinerary this particular Fatimid piece reached the Latin West. It is also unknown when exactly it left the treasury in Cairo. It is likely that it might have been sold between the years 1061 and 1069, the years in which numerous objects of the Fatimid treasuries were put on public sale to help the state to cover its huge debts. And by the way, Oleg Rabar, in the conference on the Fatimid in the end of the 80s in Paris, mentioned this moment of the dispersion of the Fatimid treasury and the selling of the Fatimid treasury in the Mediterranean as a kind of a boom in the market, in the expensive object in the market of the Mediterranean. But it is no less plausible that the piece could have fallen into the hands of the Ayyubids, who conquered Egypt and brought an end to the Fatimid reign in 1171. At any case, no later than 1350, the piece was in Venice, since, according to Hanloser, it was mounted on this reliquary in 1350 in a Venetian workshop. He refers to this mounting here, which he dates to around 1350, Venice workshop. Perhaps it reached Venice after the sack of Constantinople of 1204. In a later stage, it was somehow transferred to Vienna, where it is mentioned for the first time in 1758 in an inventory of the Geistliche Schatzkammer. It was kept there until 1887, the year it reached the German National Museum in Nuremberg. The aura of this hybrid object is remarkable. In fact, it is a medieval assemblage. Several ready-made items, such as the tiny relics, the rectangular rock crystal frame, and the two Fatimid rock crystal carved pieces with the Kufic inscription, were mounted together to form a newly designed object, a monstrance. Moreover, different medieval aesthetic notion and artistic visual languages simultaneously operate then in this object. They call the beholder's associative mind to different directions. For example, the small pieces of relic stitches as tiny flowers and buds to the branches of the vegetal motif speak the common language of reliquary pendilia and ex voto objects. The rectangular reliquary in the very center of the monstrance mainly radiates intimacy. The beholder is confronted with a small object which seems to have been made for a private use, a sort of personal amulet or talisman, which the beholder might imagine could be affixed to a chain and hanged around one's neck, just next to his chest, and which might work good and secure its owner. But the rock crystal ring, with its carved Arabic inscription, evokes quite a different impression. The rock crystal ring forming a crescent appear as an emblem, a sort of a medieval insignia or an official object of the court, which might be affixed to the very top of a spear, for example. Moreover, the lustrous and limpid transparent rock crystal encircled the reliquary, and the small holy relics within it appears like an aura floating above the head of a saint. The Arabic inscription, most probably hardly legible by the pious beholder of the reliquary, confer magical qualities to the whole piece. The inscription appears as a secret formula to be silently read or try to be read or softly murmured while looking at the relic, suggesting that the utterance of illegible words might have powerful force, with which in turn might initiate a supernatural procedure, and that then a transformation, be it material or perhaps in spirit, will occur. How should one display an object as such? In which section of the museum, European, Islamic, should it be exhibited? Which history of this object should be highlighted? Why was the object given the name the Crescent of El Zahir and not, for example, the name of the relic displayed in it? Why has the memory of its Fatimid origin been kept green, given that its appearance, since it was mounted in 1350 in Venice, mainly emphasizes its Christian identity? All these questions refer to the polytemporal with regard to a singular work of art. Each work of art has numerous history, and its life intersects several temporal zones. Moreover, in keeping to my metaphor about the anima of the object, each artifact has then many souls. And yet, and despite having fascinating history, some works of art are displayed as if crystallized, illustrating one specific moment in their adventurous history. This moment is supposedly the object's moment of creation, the very initial context in which it first operated and for which it was designed, mainly speaking, I'm saying. One of the important scholars who revised our understanding of art and highly contributed to the concept of art history as material culture and its particular relationship to time is the art historian Kubler. His influential book, The Shape of Time, published in 1962, has shaped our ideas and thought on the unique relationship between art and history, and in particular between the creative artistic act and time. In this condensed book, Kubler attacks the at-the-time traditional preoccupation of the art historian with periods and style, and freed from the framework of chronology, suggests that we unveil moments of artistic discovery, or as he called them, the shapes of time. He then organized the history of art around the products of such prime object while arranging next to each of these artistic discoveries at different distances further art production called mutants, replicas, and even forgeries. His poetical metaphor comparing the real great artists to blind people who are in the dark searching for the ultimate form and shapes of things, namely for the prime object, is illuminating. The real artists, he argues, are those who work in the dark because they do not look for traditional and convention while searching for a novel visual shape, for novel visual shapes to fulfill their artistic expression. However, it seems that his theory of the prime object is divorced from the historical context of art. Moreover, his definition of the prime object placed the originary object in an extraterritorial sphere. For he says, and I quote something that all of you here know, it would be useful first to examine the nature of the prime object from which a replica mass derives. Prime object resembled the prime numbers of mathematics because no conclusive rule is known to govern the appearance of either And although such a rule may someday be found, the two phenomena now escape regulation. Prime numbers have no diversals other than themselves and unity. Prime object, likewise, resist decomposition in being original entities. Their character as prime is not explained by their antecedents, and their order in history is enigmatic. In this passage, Kubler lays the groundwork for the idolization of the originary prime object. His theory fosters the tendency to define and demarcate the specific moment of history in which each work of art was born, as if time is thus broken from its flow into thousands of tiny moments that encompass in them the entire relevant context and zeitgeist. We, art historians, engage them, and I cite Kubler in, he says, making time tangible by arresting it. End of quote. Arresting and arranging time, I would then add, in this continuous moment, in moments of invention, in moments in which breaks with traditions and conventions occur. This notion that I dare to call the fixation of time resulted in the creation of static situations which help us to shape identities, to name a period Baroque or Renaissance, to assign work of art to specific artists, in short, to give an object a name, to answer the fundamental question of who you are. The concept of arresting time in static moment as means of classification is understandable, but the idea of prime objecthood had puzzled many scholars. A few years later, in an article published in the Annal of the New York Academy of Science in 1967, so I think there was a question if Kubler was revising his idea. 1967, Kubler slightly revised his ideas on the prime object. He writes, I'm again showing just a picture here for creating a kind of syncing with object. It's a display of Islamic art object which was made in Düsseldorf by an artist. The exhibition was called Ich esse Licht, I eat a light. Everything, now Kubler, 67, everything about a work of art is contrived to force us to perceive it as a unique object occupying one place and having usually integral properties of material, technique, form, and significance. Our habit to meeting it in a museum or on a stage or in a concert hall where it bids for our attention with the illusion that it is a single point in space, time, and feeling further masks the historical reality of every work of art. That reality is totally different from the illusion of uniqueness. Historically, he says further, every work of art is a fragment of some larger unit, and every work of art is a bundle of components of different ages, intricately related to many other works of art, both old and new, by a network of incoming and outgoing influences. These larger units, these bundles of components, and this interrelation across time and space constitute the study of historical style, which is also called stylistic analysis. Kubler's revision of his theory, and especially his new definition of a prime work of art as an imaginary single point in space, or as Christopher Wood calls it, a virtual originary point, let us swim again in the flow of time. in the network of incoming and outgoing interaction while discussing works of art because they have no fixed originary moment nor vanishing point. In fact, Kubler also modifies in this article his definition of style as a taxonomic tool and emphasizes its malleable nature. He says, styles, and I quote, being historical configuration are neither perpetual nor in random change. Being in change, however, their identity is in doubt at every instant. And his use of the words network, incoming and outgoing influences clearly attest that he evidently draws upon that which we call nowadays information theories. What are then the implications of Kubler's theory of things? If we accept that the fixation of time is untenable and that the originary object is in fact an imaginary projection, then let objects also swim in the multidimensional space of time. Let's draw into the pool the maximum of network which connects things to each other. Let's free ourselves from the restriction that the originary object poses on us as curators. Let's collect replicas and even forgeries and all artistic derivatives because all of these artifacts contribute to the intersected spaces called network. And more importantly, let's suggest new structure for a human understanding of art and art making. And let's suppose, for example, and I cite now Bruno Latour, that he says, we are going to regroup the contemporary elements along spiral rather than linear. We do have future and past, but the future takes the form of a circle expanding in all direction, and the past is not suppressed, but revisited, repeated, surrounded, protected, recombined, reinterpreted, and reshuffled. Elements that appear remote, if we follow the spiral, may turn out to be quite nearby if we compare loops. Conversely, elements that are quite contemporary, if we judge by the line, become quite remote if we traverse a spook. Such temporality does not oblige us to use the label archaic or advanced, since every chord of contemporary element may bring together elements from all times. In such framework, our actions are recognized at last as polytemporal. End of citation of Latour. There is a multiple time for each object, and therefore our action and handling, and I would even say thinking of artifact, should be polytemporal. Accepting then that time and its derivative companion space is not anymore the general collective and firm frame in which we organize things, action, ideas, and meaning, but that it is rather provisional, and therefore the relative outcome created and thereby is given volume through networks and connections. The timeness, I propose, is thus built out of varied layers of intersecting, crossing, and running parallel to other imaginative vectors of time. Of course, most of the historians and art historians alike believe that their struggle involves the restoration of past experiences, especially those hidden and covered by layers of enculturation of the object in the varied social contexts in which it has functioned. But shall we then restrict ourselves only to the archaeology of the object, I mean the past? Can research be conducted for the present or even for the future? We can begin to do this by making the object of the past meaningful and significant for the present moment, updating them by stressing their actuality and their contemporaneity. And finally, I would pose, to whatever system we engage, must we clinch to a continuity of time as the framework in which the whole network of works and function? Or should we negate this framework and see in time a discontinuous, a non-casual experience into which our being and artifact as well are inserted? I'm coming to the end. Indeed, the interference of the spectator into this provisional, broken, mosaic-like space carries into the picture a farther interactive sphere because, and let me end this paper with citing actually a Hollywood star, Ben Kingsley, who says in the film Elegy, where he played the David Kepesh, a New Yorker professor of cultural studies and the main tragic figure of Philip Roth's novel, The Dying Animal, he said there in the film, "A works of art reminds you who you are now." Thank you.